Welcome back to Shattering Mist. That was quite a second hour of the show. We're going to go to a little gentler and kinder discussion here. We're returning to Yahweh's Torah discussion. Remember, Yahweh had just explained that he was going to provide assurance to Abraham that he would inherit the benefits of the covenant, which is to live with God in his home. He had taken him to his home and told him that he was going to be transformed like light. And then Abraham said, okay, I get it. I trust you. Now I understand what you're offering. I'm going to rely on you for this. But, you know, you've done so much for me. Would you share with me how I can be assured of this? My guess, we still have Larry here with us. Larry, my guess is that Abraham asked that question not for his sake, but for ours. Added verification here would be nice. Because what is it people want to know? Don't they want to know that they're going to be saved?
Yeah, they want to know they're going to have a partnership or be a part of the cut into the covenant.
Right.
Yeah.
Little verification. And you know, did at this point did Abraham really need verification? And he just he'd been talking to God, and God just threw a party. You know, and
when he first met Yahweh, remember he got on his knees. He was in such awe, and that's when Yahweh had to say, "Don't get on
your
knees.
No, stand up. Yeah, come on, stand up." Yeah. But you know, he had to come with Yahweh, left Babylon, and made it into the promised land. And things were going splendid. God continued to meet with him, and this last time, you know, God took him to heaven and showed him the benefits of the covenant, that he was going to be like light, and that's when...
I don't think you would need much more verification.
No, and then Abraham established the second codicil of the covenant, which is, he said, declared, I trust and rely upon you, Yahweh. So that is the second codicil of the covenant. And then the third is to walk to God and become perfect. So what we have now is God explaining to Abraham for our benefit how that was going to occur. And so when I think Abraham asked this question, how can I know for sure? I think it was to allow God to explain through him to us exactly how we too could have this assurance. And so God did two things. The first we have covered in the last few programs, which is he threw a party. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's through these parties that you're going to come to have these benefits. And the first four Moed Mikre, the first four parties, unless I'm mistaken, they deliver all five benefits of the covenant.
Well, yes, they do. But there's another benefit, and that is not having to go through the great calamity, or the calamity, as Yahshua calls it, and that's trumpets. That's coming up next. I think that's a benefit.
Right. To a large degree. So the first four, which is the four that he fulfilled, and the fourth millennia of human existence outside of the garden, they provide the benefits. And so he threw a party to explain that. And then there's a second aspect to that question, because the question was, how, God, can I know for certain that this is going to occur? What do I have as proof that you're going to deliver these benefits to me as promised? And so first God explained the mechanism, which would be through these festival feasts, the Mikre. But then he transitioned to something without saying it, that is the reason that he made the transition to what occurred in Egypt. Now, Egypt did two things. One is it reaffirmed the nature of the festival feast that we're going to provide our salvation, because Pesach, Matzah, Bekunim, and Shavuot, the first four, are all lived out as an example amongst the children of Israel as they are freed from Egypt. So it tells us, here's the four, I'm going to set them into the context of Egypt when I'm going to rescue the children of Israel from Egypt. Speaks of the first four, Moed Mikre, all lived out in history during the Exodus. But it does one other thing. It interjects prophecy. And prophecy is the tool that Yahweh chose to use to prove that he exists and that he authored these instructions, and that what he has said will occur, will actually occur. since he's never wrong. And so if he consistently predicts the future accurately, and it happens exactly as he predicts that it's going to occur, then wouldn't you naturally say that that which he has promised to do for us will also occur? If he's promised to make us immortal, to make us perfect, to adopt us into his family, to enrich us and to empower us, those who have embraced the terms and conditions of the covenant, if he promised to do that, and he said, your offspring are going to be in slaves in Egypt for 400 years, and then they're going to call on me, and I'm going to free them, and that occurred, wouldn't you naturally trust that he's going to deliver on the other promises?
Well, I would, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So prophecy is a, by him transitioning to a prophecy, a detailed, specific prophecy, right down to the number of years, 400, God was thereby providing proof that he was going to deliver as promised.
And where's that at? What
we're in the midst of Bereshit, the 15th chapter. And it was where Yahweh, in the 13th verse, went on to explain the length of time that the Jews would be in Mitzrayim. He said, and he, Yahweh, said to approach and be near Abraham, Abram in this particular case, you must know with absolute certainty, yada yada, that indeed, as a foreigner living and traveling as a temporary inhabitant, your seed, your offspring, will exist in a land that is not for them. And they will serve as slaves there. And they will respond and seek resolution accordingly in 400 years. God was interjecting a prophecy because prophecy is the most effective tool that God can use to prove that he can be trusted.
And interestingly enough, yesterday I had this very debate. Mm-hmm. I had a debate with two Christians and a philosopher, I guess he was, who dabbled in every form of religion. He was an expert in the Torah, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
Philosopher. And along with the Hindu religion and the Buddhist religion.
Well, there's a lot of philosophy in the Torah. Well, there's no Kabbalah in the Torah. There's no religion in the Torah. Well, there is, in the sense of God condemns it.
Yeah, well, I understand that. That's where he was such an expert. In the end, Yahweh's words, they considered both crap, they said, and hateful. And that they decided that their God was a God of, his name was an emotion, it was love.
Okay.
So they considered Yahweh's words hateful.
Okay.
Hateful.
Well, you know, if you are genuinely loving, you have to hate. It's impossible to be.
One of the other things,
most people don't recognize that. Like, put an example. In the first 2 hours, we spoke about the vicious, merciless, and hateful nature of the Islamic religion.
Yeah, that's right.
Of all religions. But particularly, Islam is so extraordinarily deadly today. If you do not hate Islam, then you cannot be loving. You're incapable of love if you don't hate what Islam does.
There's nowhere else that a cleric, although he might do this, he won't issue a fatwa telling you how to rape a male captive. They will do that in Islam. In fact, they have.
But returning, prophecy is something that Yahweh uses to prove that he can be trusted. And one of the things that bothers me, Larry, and this would be not about philosophers but about Christians, is that Christians view prophecy as like a entertainment store. It's kind of like the thing that enables them to still look at the Torah, prophets, and Psalms without ever considering what the Torah, prophets, and Psalms actually have to say, but instead to look about these predictions so that they can write books and talk about eschatology as to how the world is going to devolve through the tribulation. So they kind of look at it as these I want to know what's going to happen next, as opposed to use prophecy for its purpose. And prophecy existed for two purposes throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and only for two purposes. It wasn't to entertain us. It was written to do two things. One is to prove that Yahweh, the creator God of the universe, authored these words, that he spoke these words, because he got every prediction precisely right. And the second was to teach us. Every prophecy comes with a profound insight that helps us understand God and the path to Him. In this particular insight, you've got 400 years, with 40 being the scriptural number for a period of testing is repeated throughout Yahweh's Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And you have the fact that in Egypt, which was this horrible mix of religion, politics, militarism, and jaundiced economic schemes that enslaved people, that wasn't a place where his children belonged. They would be foreigners there. And that the other insight is that when they finally responded to God, God reached out and saved them. And that these parties that God was throwing on behalf of Abraham, the symbolism of them is played out in Pesach, Matzah, Bikkurim, and Shavuot, the first four, Moed Mikre, during the Exodus, as God's means of removing his people from religion and politics. So there was teaching, and there was proof. And that's the purpose of prophecy. It's not a game to write a book on and say, that there's going to be this war and you ought to be, you want to be caught up in a rapture. That's not the purpose of it.
Yeah, well, there, one of the things the philosopher asked me is, how would you prove your God is real? And I said, simple, prophecy. I said that all the books that you've laid out, all the foundations and all the religions you tell me you're an expert in, then none of them provide any
prophetic
prophecy.
Proof.
Right. I laid out...
By the way, your answer there is not your answer. He asked you a question and seeking your opinion. You actually didn't give your opinion. Yahweh provides us two places in his Torah, in the 13th and 18th chapter of Devarim, which has been misnamed Deuteronomy, the test to determine whether or not he inspired someone's text. And in both of them, he includes prophecy. And he says if someone... doesn't predict the future, or if they predict the future and get one prediction wrong, they're not speaking for me. So your answer was actually God's answer. He says, that's the test. Use that test, and you will know whether or not God is real, and you will know whether or not he inspired a document that you are reading. Extraordinary appropriate test. That's how God wants us to use it. That's what we're in the midst of right now, relative to proving the validity of his covenant. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering This. So in the midst of this prophecy, we are compelled to recognize, or encouraged to recognize, that prophecy is used as the most effective means for God, whose name is Yahweh, to prove that he exists and that he inspired, and therefore authorized, the words that we're reading. And it is the one thing that is not found in any other religious document. Muhammad is called a prophet by those who are ignorant. He never issued a single prophetic proclamation that he got right. And the standard for Yahweh is 100% perfection. And every prophetic statement that Muhammad uttered turned out to be just utterly stupid. So he's not a prophet. And it's in reality, those that are called prophets really aren't prophets either. Like Yashayah, Isaiah, Yirmiyah, Jeremiah, Hosea, they're not prophets either. Moshe, who scribed the Torah, Yahweh speaking through them. Yahweh speaks in first person through them. And in fact, in this statement we're reading right now, this is Yahweh, God, speaking in first person. So when God speaks in first person through an individual, and an individual records it for our benefit, and it contains many prophetic statements, it means that God is using that individual to speak on his behalf, as opposed to that individual being a prophet. Now, there are some minor exceptions to that. There are individuals whom Yahweh, as is the case with Abraham, took from the material world up to the spiritual world in heaven and gave them the opportunity to see future events. And so since they also witnessed the future, then they can speak prophetically of it based upon their witness. A lot of that was true with Yahweh Kanan in the book of Revelation. So here's what God had to say It's now in Bereshit, Genesis 15, 14. And also, with that Gentile nation, he's speaking of Mitzrayim, the crucible of Egypt, which reduces them to slavery. I will judge them. And afterward, therefore, they shall come out with an intensely important possession. What God is speaking of here is that if you're going to be religious, if you're going to be militaristic as a people, as a nation, if you're going to be overtly politicized as a people, God's going to judge you. Now, that doesn't mean that, all of the Gentiles in Mitzrayim, Egypt, were condemned. You can be judged by God and not be condemned. In fact, the vast majority of people who are judged by God are not condemned. Now, there is no good option if you're judged by God. For example, if you're a participant in the covenant, you're not judged by God. But if you are judged by God, there's two options. One is God can say, I don't know you, you don't know me, but we really don't have a beef. You were victimized by religion or politics or militarism. You were a victim. And so somebody played you for a fool. I'm sorry, but there's nothing I can do about that. So you're just simply going to cease to exist. You've been judged, but the consequence is just is not a punishment. But some of those who are judged, like the priests in ancient Egypt, like the pharaohs in ancient Egypt, like the generals in ancient Egypt, they're going to be judged. And for them, for the carnage that they unleashed, for the misinformation they proclaimed, for the souls that they stole, there will be a consequence, and they'll end up in the black hole known as Sheol. Now, the second part of this says that they're going to come out with an intensely important possession. We know that the Exodus is based upon, began with Pesach Passover. And that the next day, the children of Israel celebrated the matzah on yeasted bread. And that on their way out of Egypt, on the third day, they became once again family through Bekorim, firstborn children. But what happened on Shavuah, seven sevens later? Do we have an answer as to what that intensely important possession might have been? What do you think it is, Larry?
The Torah. The Torah.
Yeah. So when God tells us that Shavuah is about empowering and enlightening us, enriching us, the enrichment would be His Torah teaching. Is not the Torah, and isn't the Torah, the most intensely important possession, the most valuable asset that man has ever been given? And indeed it is. And so we're going to return to consider what we can learn by studying that intensely important possession. It's true. God did not let His children come out of the servitude in Egypt empty-handed. He gave His children the most valuable possession in the universe, His Torah guidance. And that's really true for all of us. If we choose to participate in His covenant, He provides His Torah, enriching and empowering us with it. So it is the document that becomes the single most valuable map, the single most valuable constitution, the single most valuable presentation of advice in the universe. Either you use the Torah to come to know Yahweh as He is, as He introduces Himself to us, come to embrace the same perspective that He paints in and provides in His Torah so that you can view the world around you and make sense of it. And you either embrace His guidance, follow His instructions, and participate in His covenant, or you will find yourself at the end of life being judged. Now, that's not a God being mean. It's not God being harsh. The reality is that God cannot allow everyone to live forever with Him in heaven. If He were to do so, all of the hell that we're witnessing today in Iraq and Syria and throughout the Islamic world, that that kind of religious malfeasance would exist in heaven. Heaven would be no different than the hell we've created on earth. And so
you're
God
right.
has
He's to... Just creating a, he would just be creating another situation
right.
that would be unresolvable until he resolved it.
That's right. Perpetuating the same hell, the same pain and suffering that we experience here. And so God can't tolerate religion or politics or militarism in heaven. I can't tolerate the jaundiced economic schemes that have so harmed many people. He just can't do it. If he were to even fathom the idea, then his life would be miserable. Our lives would be miserable. And there'd be no opportunity to distance ourselves from the hell that human institutions have wrought upon humankind. And so God has provided us with a document that enables us to successfully navigate from the pain of mankind to the perfection of and the joy of heaven. That's what the Torah is all about. And he has given this to us for us to have as the most valuable asset in the universe. So you can choose to shamar it, which means to observe it, to closely examine and carefully consider it, or you can ignore it. And if you do ignore it, no harm, no foul. God will view the end of your life and say, you know, I don't know you. You don't know me. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed your life because that was a gift I gave you, but you squandered it. And so that's the it for you. You're just there's not going to be anything anymore. And for those that worked against him, of course, a different story.
And Yahweh's just. And in this debate I was having yesterday when they all decided that their God was love, a God I don't know, by the way, mm-hmm. when they decided that their God was love, what they really said was, we will choose to make a liar out of the creator of the universe. He'll let us in because of our love, no matter what path we took. And one thing Yahweh is honest, right down to the...
So it's their view that if they call Yahweh hateful, if they call his words disgusting, if they make a God of their own, in their own image, a God that resembles what they want God to be, so their own God, and they call that God love, that the God that they have besmirched is going to let them into heaven? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah. In other words, they're going to turn him into a liar. Uh-huh. His words won't mean anything.
Uh-huh. They're going
to
rename him. They're going
to
rename him, and then that's the renamed God that they besmirched.
Nameless
that God is going to save them.
Nameless God. He's a nameless God.
Well, he's a God named Love.
Nameless.
Yeah.
Well, I guess he's called Love. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's their plan, is that they're going to create a God in that is their own of their own creation, because they like a God that's named Love, and they're going to disregard and demean everything the actual God said, and so the actual God is going to ignore all of that and going to say, yeah, why don't you come into heaven? Because, you know, what I really want for eternity is to spend my time around somebody that hates me and demeans everything that I say, and that after showing how much they hate me, they're going to rename me Love.
You know, he the clown, I figured he was the biggest clown of the three, the philosopher, the expert.
Mm-hmm.
He asked me, he says, can you prove anything? And I said, well, you know, I said, you know, we've lived in a pretty militaristic world. You know, there's been wars forever.
Mm-hmm.
But in the eighth month of the second year of King Darius, Zechariah penned what was going to happen in a battle 20 years in our future. Mm-hmm. And I said, this is really good because you got to figure there's only a 100-year period of time in
right.
which airplanes could really be used in a battle,
right.
you know, in all of mankind.
Right.
And I laid down in that day,
mm-hmm.
and this is in the Battle of Armageddon,
mm-hmm.
Yahweh declared prophetically, I will strike every fast-moving flying weapon of war and confuse the drivers, causing them to be irrational.
All right.
And I said, now, let's think about a fast moving, flying weapon of war with a driver in it.
All right.
Do you think that Zechariah might have been shown something, or do you think he was just an excellent sci-fi writer that happened to fit this exact moment in time?
Right. And by the way, if you were to negate the avionics and those airplanes, particularly the GPS systems, the driver, the pilot of those airplanes would be completely lost. They would have absolutely no idea where they were or where they were going. They would cease to have any control over their aircraft.
Like hit them with an EMP.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what, and all an EMP is an intense amount of energy.
Sure.
So if God just had a token of his energy intervene, then all of man's technological weapons would cease to function.
But see, Yahweh says he's going to appear then in an undiminished form, so that means full of energy.
Yeah,
so
right.
It all fits perfectly. I mean,
right.
You know,
he even says that the people that don't know him, that are fighting against him then, are going to be vaporized, which is exactly what you would expect in the presence of that kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, he writes that in the preceding battle of the preceding war, the Magog War, World War III versus IV, that elements themselves were going to melt with intense heat. Speaking of atomic war.
Yeah, but I mean, we're only talking about a 100-year period of time here.
Yeah, but then also look at God's prediction. Speaking of America, that the wrath that America will endure from Muslims is going to grow out from our malfeasance in Damascus. That the destruction of Damascus is going to lead directly to this. And if it weren't for the last 2 years, you would have had no way whatsoever to understand why God would begin his prophetic indictment against America in Damascus. But now we know. America created the Damascus problem. And so, God immediately predicts that America's problem is that we thinned Israel at the waist, narrowing the country, looting it. And, you know, prior to Bush forcing Israel to give up Gaza, and now Obama forcing Israel to give up the West Bank, who would have thought that would have been possible? You know, how is it that Israel can, after being in diaspora for almost 2,000 years, can come back and occupy their homeland just as God predicts? And also, are there, you know, when, while it's not necessarily prophecy, when you examine it's historic prophecy. You know, prophecy can go in two different ways. You can reveal what happened in the past that no one else witnessed, and when it's proven to be true, that's a form of prophecy. It's just prophecy in reverse. Prophecy in the past.
Burkle crater, how
right.
I started
so,
the flood.
Right. Sure. So, yeah. So the Burkle crater, where God says that the regional flood is going to occur, you're going to commence with a welling up of seawater. And we find the Burkle crater, and it did exactly that. Or that God says, I'm going to...
It actually occurred during Noah's lifetime.
Right. Or where God says that I'm going to use a big bang to create the universe.
Oh, that's in the second.
And that the universe was created, it didn't always exist, which the scientists have come to recognize. Or
and expanding.
Right. And that God spoke about animals being created all at once and in each after their own kind, and we find the Cambrian explosion where exactly that happened.
Yeah.
Or where God says that the creation of the universe from the perspective of the Creator at creation took 6 24-hour days, and now we have determined that the time, that the wavelength of light has been stretched to 10 to the 12th power since the time of the Big Bang, which means that when you do the math, creation from the perspective that someone at creation took exactly 6 24-hour days from their perspective, because light time is relative. And so you find that every aspect of what he said is precisely accurate. When do you say, all right, well, this is beyond luck, I suppose.
Well, I also laid down the dimensions of the Ark, where
right.
The Ark rivals our most advanced ships today. I always right. wondered, why did he put these dimensions in here?
Yeah, that's why.
And now I know. It was to say, look, I'm giving you dimensions on this Ark that rival your most advanced ships today. That was for my benefit.
Right, or you when know? He told Daniel... The precise timeline from the pronouncement that his people could return to rebuild Jerusalem to the arrival of the Messiah, and
100 years in advance, and he did it to the day, and I laid that down. Do you know this dork didn't bother to read any of it? And
of course
he just
not.
Went on
with of course not, because if you can actually answer his question, because most morons can't, you can say, well, why don't you prove it? And when you actually prove it, they don't have an argument. They don't have a response.
What was their final response? Was they all agreed that love was the most important aspect of their God?
Well, you know, I wouldn't. By the way, I wouldn't disagree. I wouldn't disagree that love is the compassion, mercy, is the from our perspective is the most important aspect of Yahweh. Now, most important attribute. Well, I would say that understanding light. And how light and spirit are related, and they're disassociated from matter in the sense of power, but actually that matter is organized energy. That once you come to recognize that, you have a better understanding of who God is, and you understand how He can articulate prophecy and always be right, and you can understand what He is offering us and where what the benefits of the covenant are. I think that's vastly more important. But understanding that God's attribute is love is important too. It is amazing when you think about what the philosopher is advocating. It's the same thing, really, that Paul and Christians advocate. That you can completely disregard the Word of God. You can actually be adverse to His Torah. You can demean Him and call Him hateful. You can disassociate from His name and everything He has to say. You can disregard His plan of salvation. And then you can rename Him a characteristic that's the antithesis of what you yourself are displaying. You're showing that you hate Him and His words, but you're going to call Him now love. And that by doing that, everything will just be fine. That same God that you demeaned, who you disregarded His advice, is going to open up the doors of heaven and say, come right on in. You are really somebody that I want to spend some quality time with. Isn't that the same thing as the basis of Christianity, of Pauline doctrine?
Well, yeah, and there were two Christians involved in it. That's why they all had to decide His name was love, because they had to think that in spite of whatever He said, He didn't really mean it, because His love would overcome that. What I told them is there's another aspect of love, and that is if my neighbor's house is burning down, since this is what you want to quote about loving your neighbor, it is foolish of me to go in there and help throw firebombs at the house. Wouldn't I come with water? Wouldn't I at least let somebody know that the house was on fire? That's love.
Well, I'll give you another example. If you love your children and you knew that someone wanted to move into the house next door and they were a rat breeder, but they were testing various versions of the bubonic plague amongst their rats, and that they wanted you to demonstrate your love for your neighbor by inviting your neighbor and his rats into your home. Would you be loving as a parent if you did?
No, you wouldn't.
Would you be loving as a parent if you condemned the approach of the rat breeder into the neighborhood and the trials with bubonic plague?
Well, see, people who refuse to understand that religion's bringing this country to its, or this world, and this country, by the way, to its knees, well,
right,
they're just closing their eyes to what's going on.
Rats breeding bubonic plague.
Interest in the truth. And they're just going to say, well, I'm going to rely on these gods, by the way, that the very people that are destroying them hand them. that's where we are, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't contradict God and expect God to embrace you. God's not going to love you negating what He had to say. And in Christianity, that's what they have to do. That's why they're so opposed to Yahweh and to His Torah. And yet, if you just think it through, you'd have to recognize that they are calling God a liar. They're showing their hatred of a God who they are recreating by calling their God love. Not recognizing that it isn't loving to embrace that which is wrong.
They're also reforming Yahweh. And he even said, well, you know, you're so tied up in a name. And I said, well, I'll just call you Butch from now on, and that'll be fine in this debate. And I said, now here it is. Yahweh says to you, and speaking of prophecy, I mean, there are little prophecies like Yahweh says they're going to replace my name with Lord and all the religious material. Isn't that what happened?
Exactly.
I mean, he said it, and they did it.
And they
just prove him right every time.
Right.
But, you know, you lay that out, and I said, since, you know, love of the name as in Yahusha, Yahweh, Masiyah, you know, all things that have to do with Yah are part of being adopted into the family, and since you have no regard for the name, and he said, I don't have any real care for the name. And I said, well, it's a quid pro quo. I said, he doesn't have any regard for your name either.
Right. There you go.
This is how it works. And the whole thing started because the philosopher said, what kind of a God would allow wars and this and that? I said, I'll tell you what kind of God. One that isn't omnipresent and one that allows free choice.
Right.
And then I just showed him, you have free choice over.
Right. Free will.
And I said, by the way, to the Christians, I don't expect to win this debate with you because you're the very people, according to Matanyahu, his eyewitness account, that you're going to stand in front of Yahweh himself, call him Lord, and tell him he's making a mistake. Didn't we do this, Lord? Didn't we do this?
Oh, by the way, your friend would not exist if God was intolerant of war, because he's warring against Yahweh and his testimony, and God allows him to do so. He would not exist if God, if his God actually had the characteristics that he said, he wouldn't exist. Something to think about. We'll return to Shattering Myths on Monday. We've had a wonderful time with you this week. May Yah bless.